welcome back to Archaeology News Weekly. I am, of course, your host, David Connolly. This news is brought to you in partnership between Stone Pages and British Archaeological Jobs and Resources, along with Past Horizons. All the stories have been collected from various sources, and to view details on each story, including that source, please see the Stone Pages website at news.stonepages.com. Now, what have we got for you this week? Well, we have Estonian students finding out that Iron Age life is both smoky and cold. A prehistoric stone row is discovered in Wales. An ancient jade tool has baffled scientists. Neanderthal mammoth hunters are being researched in Jersey. We've got a 4,000-year-old artifact found in Connecticut. Underwater archaeology, we continue the hunt for the elusive Minoan Rex. And Neanderthals and their contemporaries seem to have engineered specifically stone tools. 7,500-year-old fishing village is found in Russia. And we've got evidence for popcorn in Peru. Ancient geoglyphs are found underneath the Amazonian rainforest. And hematite is used to colour ancient stones, perhaps, in Scotland. Seafaring in the Aegean. Well, we've got new dates for that and early ones. And staying in that area in Croatia, an amazing excavation has revealed the oldest known astrologer's board. Fancy a pint? Well, so did the ancient Sumerians. They fermented some sort of cereal beverage. Looking at the cuneiform, we get some idea of what they were doing, do we? Then we have the oldest evidence for ploughing in the Czech Republic. And finally, Stonehenge story of the week. Ah, yes, the Stonehenge tunnel idea has been resurrected. It's going to cost a bit, though. So let's get going with this week's news. Five students in the small Baltic state of Estonia have abandoned modern conveniences for a week in a replica wooden hut built on the site of an ancient hill fort, and have discovered that Iron Age accommodation was mainly cold, dark and smoky. You can't heat it and be in the building after dark. There's no light, said Christina Pavel, 24, who was one of the students. We tried the old method of burning a cinder of wood for light, but it just gave out too much smoke, so we just had to go to sleep earlier. Dressed in layers of thick wool and felt clothes and covered in sheepskin coats while she crochets, Pavel said that there are some basic issues modern humans take for granted, such as smokeless heating and light at night. They were worried about the cold weather and the heating, but after this morning, they feel more confident that they can last the 5 days, even though the temperature fell to, wait for it, minus 25 degrees Celsius. The hut, constructed of logs, was from a time before chimneys were in use, and this particular structure took 2 years to cut and assemble by hand. It actually sits on top of the foundations of an original Iron Age building excavated way back in 1955. The five sleep in a single low platform covered with hay, sheepskins and cloths across the back wall of the building. Inside, acrid smoke fills the windowless room and flows out of the small square door and a vent in the wall. Kirsten Ott squats on the earthen floor beneath a cloud of smoke as she cuts up meat and puts it into wooden dishes. In the corner, an open fire burned with rocks placed on top of it to help try and preserve the heat overnight. The students have to get water by melting snow. Although some of the Iron Age life is romantic, it is certainly more comfortable, as they say, living in the modern world. My take on that is we all have this fabulous or romantic idea of just how wonderful it was to live in the past. I have one word for you, dentists. Anyway, now to Wales, where Sandy Gerrard, a former English Heritage Designation Officer for 20 years, reported the discovery of an ancient stone row on the site of a proposed wind farm in Wales. It seems that the row at Mynydd Bydd's wind farm development was unnoticed by archaeologists researching the site prior to work starting. There are two roads scheduled to cross the stone row, but work has now stopped in the area around it, pending clarification by archaeologists working for Cambrian Renewable Energy Limited. Mr. Gerrard said that the stone row is probably the most important of the features found, and is associated with 30 cairns, some of them carved. It seems to form the focus of an incredibly important ceremonial landscape, where the form of space between the numerous earthworks and built elements are as integral and important as the actual earthworks themselves. Mr. Gerard has spent much of his archaeological working life on Dartmoor, and he believes the form of the newly discovered stone row is so identical to the same rows in England as to suggest a definitive, tangible link between the people. The small size of the stones reflects what was available, and even on Dartmoor, some of the rows are formed by similar sized stones. GPS measurements allowed them to trace the stone row for 700 metres. The row is aligned southwest to northeast, which again is a very common alignment for southwest England. Many of the stones peep through the peat, and many more are probably lurking beneath. The discovery of this exciting monument in Wales has been tempered, however, by the realisation that it's now going to be cut into three parts by the new road, and the feeling that if it had been known about before, perhaps more could have been done to save it. Now, some time ago, researchers discovered a 3,300-year-old stone tool on Emerau Island of the Bismarck Archipelago, a small group of islands just off the coast of New Guinea. Well, the 5-centimetre stone tool was probably used to carve or gouge wood. It seems to have fallen from a stilted house, landing in a tangle of coral reef that was eventually covered by shifting sands. The jade gouge may have been crafted by the Lapita people, who appeared in the Western Pacific around 3,300 years ago. Then they spread across the Pacific to Samoa over a couple of hundred years, and from there formed the ancestral population of the people that we now know as Polynesians. Jade gouges and axes have been found before in these areas, but what's interesting about the object is the type of jade that it's actually made of. It seems to have come from a distant region, and there is in fact the potential that the Lapita people themselves brought it from wherever they originated. In the Pacific, jadeite is as ancient as this artifact. Jadeite as ancient as this artifact is only known from Japan and Korea. Study researcher George Harlow of the American Museum of Natural History in New York has said in a statement that it's never been described in the archaeological record of New Guinea. Researchers from the American Museum of Natural History then studied the artifact with X-ray microdiffraction, that's what I would have used, trying to pinpoint the origin of rocks. When they first looked at the artifact, it was clear that it didn't match anything that anyone knew about jadeite jade. The artifact's chemical composition makes very little sense based on how they knew these rocks formed. The jadeite in the rock is different from the jadeite found in Japan and Korea at this time, is missing certain elements and has more than expected amounts of others. The stone came from another geological research source, but the researchers just are not sure where. The only chemical match the researchers knew of was, wait for it, in Baja California in Mexico. The researchers don't think it's likely that Neolithic people thousands of years ago could have transported it across the Pacific, but they couldn't find any other explanation. However, in an unpublished 20th century German manuscript, C.E.A. Wichmann described curious rocks from Indonesia, about 600 miles from the site where the jade tool was found, and the chemical properties that he reported seemed to match this artifact. Researchers are now investigating these samples to see if modern techniques can prove that the tool actually came from Indonesia. What a mystery. Good luck to them there. Now, archaeologists are investigating evidence that Ice Age Neanderthals in Jersey would drive mammoths off cliffs in St. Brulade for food. Dr. Jeff Smith, an analyst for Jersey Archive, is using new technologies to look at whether the theory is correct or not. He's recording the ages of the animals to see if they resemble natural deaths or whether it's indicative of human hunting or other carnivore. In the cave at La Côte, archaeologists have over the years found tools and fossilized bones and teeth of woolly mammoth, woolly rhinoceros, cave bear and reindeer. These remains date from a time when the view was not a sea, but a huge treeless land stretching all the way to what's now Saint-Malo. groups of nomadic hunters would move northwards in the spring, following the animals to their summer pastures in the place where England is today. On the steep cliffs at the edge, it was postulated that the people would hunt for large game by stampeding them over the edge. Have to comment there, I had to actually slightly edit that from push them over the edge, because I just had this terrible image of a group of Neanderthals desperately trying to push this huge woolly mammoth off a cliff. I can't imagine it would go for that. Now, an ancient spear point was found at an excavation site in Connecticut during a Norwalk Community College-sponsored archaeology dig. Chelsea Dean, senior at Fairfield Ludlow High School, took part in the Introduction to Archaeology course with Professor Wiegand last autumn as part of the school's avocational programme. During the last dig of the semester, Chelsea found a complete spear point, more than 4,000 years old. One of the things that she learned taking the course was that she actually wants to continue with archaeology. Oh dear, dear, dear. Whether it's career or recreational, well, I wish her all the best on this one. If you're wondering what she found, though, it was a burwell projectile point made of quartzite. The excavation at Gallows Hill Road has been a 10-year project by Mr. Wiegand, and his students in the dig will continue when he and his students return in the spring. Not to be outdone, of course, Daniel Crewson, a local historian and archaeologist, said the spear point find is not uncommon for the area. During several digs at Putnam Park, Mr. Crewson had headed since 2001. A component of an Indian camp was uncovered along with other finds. We found a complete projectile point as well, and seven or six broken ones, the stone biface made of quartz. The finds also date to between 4,000 and 5,000 years. I can see a bit of rivalry there between these two. Now to the elusive Minoan wrecks. Brendan Foley, a marine archaeologist at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute in USA, and his colleagues at Greece's Euphrate of Underwater Antiquities, made a four-week survey of the waters around Crete last October as part of a long-term effort to catalogue large numbers of ancient shipwrecks in the Aegean Sea. The grand prize would be a wreck from one of the most influential and enigmatic cultures of the ancient world, the Minoans, who ruled these seas more than 3,000 years ago. A Bronze Age wreck called Uluburun shows how the remains of a single ship can transform archaeologists' understanding of an era. This one, discovered in 1982, about 9 kilometres southeast of Kash in southern Turkey, dates from around 1300 BCE. A century or two after the Minoans had disappeared. It took 10 years to excavate, and researchers are still studying nearly 17 tons of treasures that were recovered, including ivory, ebony, ostrich eggs, resin, spices, weapons, jewellery and textiles, as well as ingots of copper, tin and glass. What really stunned archaeologists was that the artefacts on this one vessel came from at least 11 different cultures. The Uluburun sailed at the time of Tutankhamun, yet it is far more important than any Tutankhamun tomb as a contribution to our understanding of the period. Well, so says Shelley Waxman, an expert on ancient seafaring at Texas A&M. The earlier Minoans set the stage for such a widespread trading network through their domination of the eastern Mediterranean, and what archaeologists crave is a Minoan equivalent of Uluburun, a long-distance trading ship packed with valuable cargo that will reveal exactly how different cultures of the time interacted. Robert Ballard, an oceanographer based at the University of Rhode Island, has pioneered deep-sea exploration and discovered wreck of the Titanic in 1985. Ballard has spent years searching for ancient wrecks and has learned the importance of finding areas beyond the reach of the fishing trawlers which scour the sea floor, destroying archaeology in the process. Historians once assumed that the number of wrecks on the deep sea were negligible, but in the 1990s, Ballard found 8 ancient wrecks far from shore between Sicily and Sardinia. It seems the ancient mariner was not afraid of going out to sea. He believes that Minoan ships are waiting out there to be discovered. Foley estimates that hundreds of thousands of ships must have sunk in ancient times, thousands in the Bronze Age alone. That could shift maritime archaeologists into an era where they can use statistical data gathered to build up a bigger picture of trade routes, migration and warfare throughout history. We'd rather find 500 ships than excavate one, says Ballard. Many a true word there. Newly published research from anthropologists at the University of Kent in the UK has scientifically supported for the first time the long-held theory that early human ancestors across Africa, Western Asia and Europe engineered their stone tools. For over a century, anthropologists had debated the significance of a group of Stone Age artefacts manufactured by at least three prehistoric hominin species, including Neanderthals. These artefacts, collectively known as Levallois, were manufactured across Europe, Western Asia and Africa as early as 300,000 years ago. Levallois artefacts are flat stone tools described as prepared cores shaped in a deliberate manner, such as only after such specialised preparation could a prehistoric flint knapper remove the distinctive Levallois flake. Levallois flakes have long been suspected to be intentionally created by prehistoric hominins for unique standardised properties of size and shape. Now, an experimental study in which a modern-day flint knapper replicated hundreds of Levallois artefacts supports the notion that these flakes were indeed engineered. By combining experimental archaeology with morphometrics, which is a study of form, and statistical analysis, the Kent researchers have proved that Levallois flakes removed from these types of prepared cores are significantly more standardised than the flakes produced incidentally during Levallois core shaping. These are called debitage flakes. Importantly, they identified the specific properties of these flakes that would have made them preferable. Among the variety of choices, these tools are superflakes. They're not so thin that they're ineffective, but they're not so thick that they can't be resharpened effectively or be unduly heavy to carry, which have been very important to groups such as Neanderthals who need some sort of portable tool. Now, a team of Spanish and Russian archaeologists have documented a series of seines, or large fishing net systems made to hang vertically in the water by weights at the lower edge, floats at the top, and other types of fish traps on the banks of the River Dubna, 100 kilometres north of Moscow, which date to more than 7,500 years ago. The equipment, among the oldest in Europe, displays great technical complexity. The survey will aid in understanding the role of fishing among European settlements by the early Holocene, that's around 10,000 years ago, especially in areas where the inhabitants did not practice agriculture until nearly the Iron Age. Ignacio Clement, researcher at the CSIC and manager of the project, explains that until now it was thought that Mesolithic groups had been seasonal as opposed to permanent, and therefore had seasonal as opposed to permanent settlements. According to the results obtained during the excavations in both Mesolithic and Neolithic periods, the human group that lived in the Dubna River Basin near Moscow carried out productive activities during the entire year. According to Clement and his team, the inhabitants prefer to hunt during the summer and winter, fish during the spring and early summer, and harvest wild berries at the end of summer and into autumn. While it's commonly accepted that the first permanent settlements appeared with the rise of agriculture around 10,000 years ago, that theory overlooks other valid possibilities, such as the fishermen of the Bay of Biscay, who did not cultivate land until long after the practice had actually reached Spain, about 5,000 years ago. The recent Russian findings support a new hypothesis that fishing could allow certain populations to become sedentary. During the three-year project, which has just ended, several types of objects were found. Everyday objects such as spoons and plates, working tools, hunting weapons and fishing implements, all of them manufactured with flint and bone as well as other stones as well. Clement adds that this documented fishing equipment shows a highly developed technology utilising several fishing techniques. They can highlight the finds of two large wooden fishing traps, a kind of interwoven basket with pine rods used for fishing. very well preserved, dating back 7,500 years. This represents one of the oldest dates in the area and no doubt among the best preserved, since they still maintain some of the joining ropes manufactured with vegetable fibres. In addition, the researchers have recovered related objects such as hooks, harpoons, weights, floats and needles for the manufacture and repair of nets, as well as moose rib knives to scale and clean the fish. The Zamoście II site has preserved numerous organic remains such as wood, bones, tree leaves, fossil feces and fish remains. These will allow researchers to estimate the percentage of fish in the diet, survey the species, and catch amount and size, as well as even the fishing season itself. The team have also found abundant remains of hunting, mostly moose, beaver, and dog. The team traced the occupational presence throughout the entire year, revealing that these people were not nomadic. The greatest secret, however, still to understand is exactly how these fish traps were constructed. With no real idea how they managed such thin rods of pine, they're thinking it could have been that they had to wait until the wood was frozen. And now, no sign of a movie, but we've got the earliest evidence of popcorn found in Peru. The first evidence of the domesticated production of corn in the Americas can now be pushed back to 7,000 BCE. It was developed from a wild grass called tesonete, and after a few thousand years, its usage in cultivation spread across South America, and evidence has now been found in areas even before the use of pottery. Until now, the earliest evidence had only dated back as far as 3,000 BCE. Now, a team of scientists from the Washington Natural History Museum have found evidence of processed and cooked corn in Peru, dating from 4,700 BCE. Dolores Pepereno, a curator of New World Archaeology at the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History, is quoted as saying, "These new and unique races of corn may have developed quickly in South America, where there was no chance that they could continue to pollinate with the wild teosinte. Because there is so little data available from other places for this time period, the wealth of morphological information about the cobs and other corns remains at this early date very important for understanding how corn became the crop that we know it today." Now, heading south, we go into the Amazonian rainforest, in an area on the western boundary of the Brazilian Amazon known as Acre. Rare geoglyphs have been uncovered by a farmer clearing his land. The area has long been believed to have been forested for thousands of years with no appreciable human occupation, but this theory is now under fire. The farmer, a Senor Arejo, thought at first they were part of an abandoned fortification from the Bolivian War, but recent work by archaeologists has dated them to between 1,000 and 2,000 years old, representing a picture of the landscape in the time before Columbus arrived in the Americas. The geoglyphs uncovered on this land are earth avenues up to 6 meters wide and half a meter deep even now. Alceu Ranze, a Brazilian paleontologist involved in uncovering some of the geoglyphs, believes that they are highly significant. He's quoted as saying that what impressed him most was the geoglyphs' geometric precision and how they emerged from the forest that everyone had been taught before was untouched, except by a few nomadic tribes. These finds now are, however, causing alarm bells to ring with environmentalists as they present a view of a much smaller original rainforest. William Woods, a geographer who's part of the team investigating the Acre site, is quoted as saying, "If one wants to recreate pre-Columbian Amazonia, most of the forest actually needs to be removed, with many people and a managed, highly productive landscape replacing it." One has to make a small mention here. It's not going to be exactly the same sort of vast clearance and destruction of the Amazon rainforest that we're seeing just now. This is a very, very carefully managed, productive landscape. It also strangely confirms the tales of Francesco de Orellana, who talked of towns in occupation with fields the whole length of the Amazon River back in the 1540s. But when Western explorers returned, they saw none of it and thought he was just making it up. But it now seems that Forrest had reclaimed the land after a great disaster. Now to my own bonny Scotland, where archaeologists working on the prehistoric site at Daher in the Lowther Hills, an extensive area of hill country in the southern uplands of Scotland, are discovering further sites within a forestry plantation. Now, for the first time, the bigger archaeological group has found colouring substances used by hunter-gatherers over 6,000 years ago. The group leader, the inimitable Tam Ward, explained how hematite was being rubbed on stones to give a bright maroon-coloured powder, which makes a very good paint. How it was actually being used, though, is still unknown. The overlap between the hunters and the first farmers has also been found, and it's causing some excitement. This is an absolutely fabulous project, and I highly recommend that you Google Bigger Archaeological Group, that's B-I-G-G-A-R, Archaeological Group, and find out more about this remarkable landscape that's being uncovered by volunteers. Now, seafaring before the Neolithic, around about the 7th millennium BCE, is a controversial issue in the Mediterranean. However, evidence from different parts of the Aegean is gradually changing this, revealing the importance of early coastal and island environments. The site of Uriokos on the island of Lemnos in Greece tentatively dates to the end of the Pleistocene and possibly the beginning of the Holocene, so we're looking at a date of around 12,000 years ago. A team of our archaeologists and geologists from various universities suggest that the obsidian sources on the island of Melos in the Cyclades could have been exploited earlier. Studies of material from Franchitti Cave in the Argolid indicate that Melos was the origin, but obsidian hydration dating was not applied to the artefacts recovered from there. Obsidian or volcanic glass has been a preferred material for stone tools wherever it is found or traded. It also absorbs water vapour when exposed to air, for instance when it's shaped into a tool, and absolute or relative dates can be determined for that event by measuring the depth of water penetration. So in 10,000 years, the expected hydration depth is about 10 millimetres from the tool surface. Two routes for the obsidian found at Franchitti have been considered. A direct one of around 120 kilometres with islets in between, and another one through Attica, including crossings of 15 to 20 kilometres between islands. The presence of obsidian in mainland and island sites indicates that these voyages included successful return journeys. Sites in Icaria and Sporades and on Kythnos demonstrate that during the Mesolithic, a well-established system of obsidian exploitation and circulation existed, a phenomenon that has its roots even earlier, as dates from the sites in Attica indicate. Furthermore, obsidian artefacts have recently been found in two other Mesolithic sites in Greece and one of the islands of Naxos and the other one on the small island of Halki. Exchange systems therefore brought obsidian to the eastern and northwest Aegean and even reached coastal island inland sites of mainland Greece, such as Attica, though they've not yet been found on mainland sites. Possibly through sites in this later region, obsidian was also brought to the Peloponnese. Now, a research team has discovered what may be the oldest astrologer's board used to depict a person's horoscope in the Nakovana cave, famous for its conspicuously phallic stalagmite. Believe me, I've seen it. It is definitely conspicuously phallic in shape. This is overlooking the Adriatic Sea in Croatia. Dating back more than 2,000 years, the surviving portion of the board consists of 30 ivory fragments inscribed with signs of the zodiac in a Greco-Roman style. They include images of a crab, Cancer, twins, Gemini, and a fish, Pisces. The fragments were discovered next to the phallic-shaped stalactite amid thousands of pieces of ancient Hellenistic drinking vessels. Jones and Stasio Forbar, a researcher with the Institute for Anthropological Research in Zagreb, reported the discovery in the most recent edition of the Journal of History of Astronomy. In 1999, the team were digging near the entrance of the cave, well known to people at the nearby hamlet of Nakovana, who simply called it Spila, which imaginatively is Croatian for the cave. What no one knew at the time was that the cave had another section sealed off for more than 2,000 years. Forambar's girlfriend, who's now his wife, you would hope so after having to do this, burrowed through the debris and discovered a low, wide passageway that continued for 10 metres into the interior. Forambar described going through the passageway as a unique King Tutankhamun experience, coming into a place where nobody had been for over 2,000 years. There was a very thin limestone crust on the surface that was cracking under their feet when you went in, which meant that nobody had been there for a very, very long time. When the archaeologists investigated, they found the phallic-shaped stalactite, numerous drinking vessels that had been deposited over hundreds of years, and something else. In the course of that excavation, these very tiny pieces of ivory started coming up. What followed was years of putting them together, finding more of them, and figuring out exactly what they were. Archaeologists are not certain how the board came to be in the cave or where it was originally made. Radiocarbon tests show that the ivory dates back to 2,200 years ago, shortly before the appearance of this form of astrology. The signs would have been attached to a flat, possibly wooden surface to create the board. There's definitely a possibility that this astrologer's board showed up as an offering, together with other special things that were either brought or plundered from passing ships. He pointed out that the drinking vessels found in the cave were very carefully chosen. They were almost all foreign-made, with only a couple of examples of cruder amphora storage vessels found amongst them. The phallic-shaped stalactite appears to have been the centre of the offering. Now, archaeologists from the Ludwig Maximilian University, together with brewing experts from the Technical University of Munich, carried out an experiment in an attempt to replicate the beer of ancient Sumer in Mesopotamia. Cuneiform writing scholar Peter Damaro of the Max Planck Institute believes that although the experiment produced a brew, it only demonstrates that modern methods can produce a beer under ancient conditions. However, he does think the experiment was a step in the right direction. That's nice of him. Damaro wrote in the Cuneiform Digital Library Journal, "Given our limited knowledge about the Sumerian brewing process, we cannot say for sure whether their end product even contained alcohol. Although many of the more than 4,000-year-old cuneiform texts contain records of deliveries of emmer, barley and malt to breweries, as well as documentation of the activities, there's hardly any information on the production process itself, and there's no recipe. Moreover, the methods used for recording this information differ between locations and time periods, and the records and calculations are not based on any consistent number system. Sumerian bureaucrats used a different number system depending on the nature of the object to be counted or measured." That was good of them. "This has cast doubt on the popular theory that Mesopotamian brewers used to crumble flatbread made from barley or emmer into their mash. The so-called bapir, which is Sumerian for beer bread, is never counted as bread in the administrative text, but as a measuring unit, like coarsely ground barley. Such interdisciplinary research efforts might well lead to a better interpretation of the hymn of Ninkasi than those that are currently accepted by specialists working in cuneiform literature. The hymn of Ninkasi is a mythological poem or lyric text from the old Babylonian period, from around about 1800 BCE, which glorifies the brewing of beer and is one of the most significant sources on this ancient art. But it provides no reliable information about the ingredients, nor does it conclusively describe the procedure. Well, I'd like to volunteer my own services to continue the research into this brew here." Now, archaeologists in Prague, Bobegnik, have uncovered a site with the oldest traces of field ploughing in the Czech Republic that dates back to the mid-4th millennium BCE. The most important find in this system of four approximately parallel lines that cover an area of 9 metres long and 10 metres wide and 8 metres deep, which archaeologists believe are, wait for it, furrows. Experts believe these furrows date back to the earliest phase of the Copper Age, so between 3800 and 3500 BCE. The oldest evidence on the use of primitive ploughs in Europe also coincide with this period. Now, on that shock, stunning news, we get to the last story. Yes, the Stonehenge Stone is so exciting I can't even say it. Do I even want to say it? I don't know, but I'm going to go on anyway. The Stonehenge tunnel idea has been resurrected. Yes, the idea of building a tunnel under Stonehenge has been resurrected by a consortium of council leaders from across the southwest of England. Wiltshire was among the authorities represented at a summit meeting to discuss the A303 improvements organised by Somerset County Council last week. They discussed ways to raise the £1 billion needed to widen the remaining single-lane sections of the road between Wiltshire and Devon. The tunnel, which would cost more than £500 million, that's at the last count, is one of the five separate schemes that are believed are needed. Somerset leader Ken Maddock believes there's scope to seek new funding in the light of the UK Chancellor George Osborne's autumn statement, which said that pension funds could be used to fund up to £20 billion of infrastructure schemes. He said, "This is a fabulous opportunity to put a joint bid together that will bring huge benefits to the whole of the West Country." The 2.1-kilometre tunnel plans were shelved in 2007 after the government said the soaring costs were just not justified. £1 billion. I am absolutely dumbfounded. This is surely our Stonehenge story of the week, which leaves me, and I hope you lot, in tears. But what won't leave you in tears is, of course, lots and lots of fabulous news and stories from Past Horizons. Yes, www.pasthorizons.com, where you're not only going to get the news and the stories, but you're also going to get the tools and the projects to use them on. Get yourself down there. Can I also remind people that more can be found at Stonepages News. Stonepages.com. Thank you so much for listening to this extended version, 37 minutes long, of the Archaeology News Weekly. I'm David Connolly. I've lost my voice, and I'll look forward to talking to you again next week.